Welcome to Crazy for Love, an audio program from the Exploratorium's Mind Project, funded by the National Science Foundation. This program explores love and the mind, particularly romantic love and attraction. What is love? That one word encompasses so much, from the mammal-to-mammal nurturing affection we feel toward a pet, to the obsessive, intrusive, lustful crush we have on a celebrity. In this program, we may not definitively answer the question, what is love, but we will explore a few of the many faces of love. First, we'll examine a teenage girl's overwhelming obsession with a certain pop star, the king of pop, in fact. Then we'll hear from people, your average person on the street, about their celebrity crushes and varied romantic experiences. And finally, we'll talk with Dr. Richard Lannan, a psychiatrist and author who spent 40 years working to make sense of love. He'll shed some light on why love is such a powerful and guiding force in our lives, why we're so motivated to seek it, and how it may not be as crazy or mysterious as it feels. Dr. Lannan may be able to give us some insight into that eternal question, why do fools fall in love? So let's get started. First, Isabel.
I'm just going to start rolling, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine with me. You know, to be honest, I don't completely remember when it started. This is like pre-major nose job stuff. So definitely Thriller. But I think, no, you know what? My first LP was Off the Wall. And just slowly, I guess the obsession began. The music, when I would listen to it, I would get really inside of it. I really actually really appreciated the music for the journey that it would give me and the freedom of the fantasy life. It's sort of the soundtrack of my fantasy life. Sometimes it would make me cry in just pure emotion, you know, when the music would swell or when it would come and go. And there's a song, Cuts Me Like a Knife, and he cries in the middle, and of course I would cry every time. I really felt like I had a special connection to him that was perhaps unique. I don't think it was in my radar that there could be anybody else who felt this deeply about him and his music. I don't think it even occurred to me that that was possible, that it was a phenomenon, you know, that I wasn't the only one. I felt like it meant that there was something, that it had to mean something. There was some destiny to it. Somehow, I was going to end up with a life with him, like a personal relationship with him. I'm not sure I bridged all the way to like a sexual relationship with him, but that we had this soul connection. The girl who lived upstairs from me, her mother owned the building, and she, I think, was only about a year older than me. And right when my sort of obsession with Michael Jackson was happening, she was brewing something for Duran Duran. And I remember when it sort of changed into a direction of, okay, this is perhaps not so healthy, was when she was grounded for trying to tattoo Duran Duran, the words Duran Duran, into her leg with a pin, like a sewing pin or that sort of thing. She scratched the words and then took a ballpoint pen and drew over it so that the ink would go into her skin. She had to go to the doctor and the whole thing, the whole, like, you know, she could have poisoned herself. She had to take all of her posters down. And I remember that being a big deal of like, wow, that's pretty serious. Maybe that was my first exposure to when love goes awry. You know, there's love and obsession and sort of how it takes you for a ride. And then there's like the dark side of that.
Then there's the pins.
And then there's the pins and ink. So my stepdad, he grew up in Santa Monica, so we used to go down to L.A. a lot. And he had a friend who lived in Encino, and I was very aware of where Michael Jackson lived. You know all these little details about them, right? And knew he lived in Encino, we were going down to LA for a trip, and he said he wanted to go visit his friend who recently had moved to Encino, or some reason we were going there. And of course, Encino, we have to go to Michael Jackson's house. Oh my God. I think I had this image that it was somewhat like a castle we were going to find, and there was going to be this humongous entrance. It was going to be like the clouds part right about there. It was this wall that you couldn't see much over it. It had a bunch of trees and then a gate. And that's pretty much it. But I think we figured out that that, yes, indeed, was the place, was because there was a, on the opposite side of the road, was a little clearing for you to park your car, and there were a couple cars parked there and a couple people standing there just sort of looking. We stood there for a while, and I don't think I said much. All of a sudden, a gold Rolls Royce, which was what I knew to be his car, rolled down the street, and the gates open, and this one little hand, gloved hand, just kind of went like this in the window. Couldn't see him. Oh, and then, you know, that's when it's like my face flushed and, you know, adrenaline came through and the, you know, oh my God. But not even a freak out of, it wasn't like what you see, like, films of the Beatles and the girls in the stands and they're screaming their heads off and flipping out. It was much more of a quiet experience for me. It was all just everything heating up and everything just it was like a swell. It was like a wave, just a swell of heat and my heart starting to race. And yeah, and then there he went through his gates and boom, done. One little wave, that's all it took. So we got in the car. Oh, okay, there was Michael Jackson. We had our sighting. Oh, here we go. And I got sort of shuffled into the car, and it was very quiet in the car, and I think I just kind of went to a place and stayed there. And so we got to my stepdad's friend's house, and I said, I'm going to have to excuse myself for a little bit. I'm going to go lie down. And so I went for like a half an hour and laid down because I just couldn't quite be with it with anyone. I couldn't be with anyone else for that time. I needed time to process that. And it wasn't even something I was actively processing. It had a process of its own to just all that emotion that doesn't even have specifics to it. It's just this swelling of emotion. It was too much for my poor little body to be able to handle, my poor little mind, my little heart. Just, it was so much that, yeah. And I don't think it died down from there. I think it actually, that's when it really came to its full bloom of oh yeah, we're connected. Of all the times he could come and go, it was the time that I was standing there. It's destiny. There's a reason for everything.
This program was produced in San Francisco, a city known for its wide-open heart. So I was hoping that if I walked around town, I might find a few brave people willing to divulge their own celebrity crushes and maybe talk about other experiences with love and romance. It's amazing what people will tell you if you just ask.
My first was Donny Osmond. And I think it was the hair that did it. And I think that was my very first crush, that voice and that look. And I don't know if it was so much that I wanted to be with him or be him, but the lines were a little blurred.
I liked Johnny Depp and Jude Law. I think it was very distant for me, and I knew it wasn't much of a reality, but I like to watch all the movies and keep up with the gossip.
Kathy Ireland. God, I loved her. Dark hair, beautiful. I would dream about her every night. And her and Kelly LeBrock from Weird Science. Old, like, 80s movie.
And what was the first romantic crush you ever had, you know, in real life?
I had a crush on a girl before a guy.
Yeah.
And it was just a playmate of mine that used to come over all the time. And we started making out just to try out kissing. So it was a girl, actually.
So it was fifth grade. A little girl. Her name was Laurie. Still remember her. You always remember the first one. It was the famous song at the time called Volare, which means to fly in Italian. But at the time, I didn't know that, and I thought it had something to do with her name, so I kept singing Volare.
Probably my last year in high school. Nothing too much came of it, but I think that was the first one.
Oh, well, see, I'm gay, so it was a man that I met when I was at the University of Pittsburgh, and so that didn't last very long, but I think that was probably the first.
First or second grade? Just a girl I went to school with. I just remember, going to her house and hanging out at her house and having her come to my house and just kind of... almost simulating what it would be like to have a wife or kind of like a marriage type of relationship as we got older. But it was kind of weird. Neither one of us had any idea what that really was, I guess, except for our parents. But we kind of simulate that in certain ways, not romantically, not sexually or anything, but just playing house.
What's the strongest infatuation you've had at any age?
They've been bad. They've been really bad. I've done some really foolish things. I've been stupid for Cupid a lot of times. Have lent men money, never gotten it back. Men that made more money than I did. Hopefully that's not happening anymore, but I was definitely always the person that was struggling to please and always getting the short end of the stick. So
probably my latest relationship, so it was a year and a half, and, I thought I was in love, and it ended horribly, so it obviously wasn't meant to be, but it was definitely my strongest infatuation.
Wife. Goes up and down, but it's been basically the strongest.
Has there ever been a time when you've had a strong physical reaction to love or attraction, like fainting, shaking, feeling ill?
Yeah, but it was more positive. Definitely... blushing or being able to sense the person in the room, this real sense of excitement and happiness. Not anymore, but definitely in my 20s.
I think that those emotions, the shaking and stuff and all that, they come out actually when the relationship is ending. Like, I just ran into my ex-boyfriend and I was just like, like shaking, and I hadn't even seen him in 2 months, and I'm kind of over the relationship. It was just still that... I would say I haven't been swooned or, like, fainted or, like, done any kind of thing like that, but I think it's when everything's going wrong is when those kind of emotions for me arise.
You feel ecstatic, see beautiful things. Every moment is heightened sensibility. You feel great, like you're walking on air. Very foolish. Those things disappear as you get older. But maybe not. Maybe some people fall in love when they're old.
Most of us can relate to some or all of these stories. We've all had firsthand experience with love. But we usually navigate our way through the labyrinth of love and romance on a heart level without intense scientific scrutiny. We tend to think of our adventures in love as very personal, each one of us our own unique case study. But Dr. Richard Lannan, a psychiatrist, author, and professor at the University of California at San Francisco, has been studying the science of love and the brain for 40 years. Along with fellow UCSF doctors Fari Amini and Thomas Lewis, he wrote a book about the psychobiology of love called A General Theory of Love. The book argues that while love is indeed mysterious and huge and difficult to define, it does exist in the physical world, inside our brains, and therefore that it can be observed and better understood scientifically. While we might feel that our romantic impulses are mad and mysterious, at odds with our intellect or better judgment, a general theory of love presents an alternative view. Our desires to connect, to fuse with others, are deeply embedded in our origins as mammals. We are wired for love, and a teenage girl worshiping Michael Jackson might, in a way, be fulfilling her destiny, as a primate at least.
There are patterns in love. There are processes that occur in people who are mammals that are involved in love, and they can be understood. But in some ways, the process of love, the living of love, the being in love, is tremendously mysterious. So in some ways, you live it, and then you can kind of make sense out of it. And science helps make a lot of sense out of it. But, I mean, the process of it is so delightfully human that one just has to sort of accept that and kind of ride with it. One of the fascinating things with a crush or with falling in love is, in some ways, it's a very individual experience. You are swept away in your own imaginings, in your own fantasies, in your own dreams, and they're really your own. The sense of falling in love with a celebrity, I mean, that's all you. Chances of that celebrity ever really having a relationship with you is pretty slim. This is all in your mind. You know, as you get older and you get more experienced and you have a better way of dealing with your emotions, then, in a sense, you can have a more directly passionate involvement with another person that is going to be there, that is very much a real person. Now, you'll probably do a lot of very surprising, unexpected, dangerous things when you're in the throes of that kind of feeling tone with someone else. The falling in love, which is such a, again, mysterious feeling, and probably, as we get to know it from a science perspective, has a lot to do with hormones like oxytocin, neuropeptides that get released in the brain, or dopamine. Dopamine is what's related to the pleasure center, so things that cause a sense of reward or pleasure, you know, and that can be like a video game. Can do that, but it also can be seeing the one you love. It's often asked, can sort of a well-balanced, very healthy human being experience symptoms of mental illness when they're early in the falling in love experience or early in a relationship, or even when a relationship is in trouble. And definitely, I mean, when you're falling in love, you're not necessarily seeing reality at all. You really can misjudge who the other person is. And that can be pretty profound. I mean, you can look at somebody and really mis-see them. So your visual system can be giving you the wrong input. You might not be seeing what you think you're seeing, which is kind of amazing sometimes, but it's certainly true. You know, the expression "love is blind" is really very, very accurate. And you may, like people, almost have like an acid experience where the person just is glowing, or they take on a kind of psychedelic edge to them. Then there are a bunch of things that happen when you start to actually feel connected to the person. Like you can have phenomena involved with separation anxiety, being, you know, like losing the other person, or fear of losing the other person, or what if something happened to the other person. So tremendous anxiety symptoms. And all of these things touch on very significant mental illness symptoms. So sometimes it's kind of hard to tell when you're in the throes of love, you know, are you really healthy or not? And, you know, in some ways, a lot of the symptoms that I just talked about are healthy. I mean, they're just the way it is. I think the seeking of love is really trying to satisfy our deepest yearnings as a human being. Most of the time, if we're relatively healthy, we want to form a connection with other people and with a lover and with family. And that goes right to our core as human beings. And there's a lot of science now that looks at what happens with infants if they're not given love. They can be fed, they can be sheltered, they can have all the creature comforts that they want, but if they're not loved, if they're not emotionally related to, they will die. So in orphanages where there is no tender love and care, where there's no connection, where they're left alone, those children have a very high rate of death and of illness, and if they do survive, they are very emotionally and intellectually deprived. So in a sense, it's not like love is just an idea or just, you know, like, wow, it's a great thing. It's really so important for our development, our neurological development, our body growth, our physiology, our emotional development. And that continues through life. I mean, we need other people and we need emotional attachment to stay emotionally healthy in our life and to handle all the stresses of life. People do a lot better handling illness when they are in a relationship. It's a vital, real nurturant that we have to have, and it goes right from birth all the way to death, that we need other connection and we need love.
Perhaps the great mysteries of love will never be completely explained. But by thinking of love and our intense emotional experience of love in terms of the psychobiological processes that make our minds work, perhaps we can understand ourselves just a little better. And with the tools to observe the human brain becoming more sophisticated all the time, it's possible that we may come to understand things about ourselves that we can't even imagine now. Please visit www.exploratorium.edu/mind for more mind-related media. And be sure to visit the Exploratorium in San Francisco to experience our collection of new exhibits exploring attention, emotion, judgment, and the workings of your own mind. I'm Dia Felix, your host and producer. Music is by Kristen Milner.
Exploratorium.